Linuxcast, a podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. We record every other week on Sunday afternoons. Watch the Mintcast website for the schedule. Livestream information is at mintcast.org/livestream. We're in the Mintcast channel at IRC at irc.spotchat.org. If you see something that you'd like to hear about, tell us. Send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. Join us on MeWe, on Facebook, on the Mintcast subreddit. We've got Telegram, we've got Discord, or you can post directly at mintcast.org. Welcome to Mintcast episode 306. I'm Leo, and with me today we've got Bo.
How's everybody doing?
We've got Joe.
Hello again.
We've got Tony Watt.
Greetings.
We've got Josh.
Hello.
We've got Tony Hughes.
Hi, guys.
And maybe the least, but probably not, Moss.
Don't worry about me, none. I'll be all right.
And first up in our wanderings this week, we're going to hear about a new Pi and podcast project. Bo has some Proton updates. Joe's been playing with some app images. Tony Watts has been arcading it up. Josh has a Manjaro journey, and Tony Hughes has been working with LMDE, and Moss and Tony have been playing around with a new podcast while Moss continues the struggle with Solus. Then Asus, in our news, Asus has a bug, Intel has some hidden features, we cover Linux Mint Monthly News, Spurv makes an appearance, Amazon wants their own internet, and finally, Huawei has creepy crawlies too. We hit our innards section, which covers a ton of Pi stuff. And finally, we cover listener feedback. And Bo loves Arch. I almost caught it. Almost. Well, let's head over to our biweekly wanderings and dive into all of that.
Arch Mint edition.
There it is. So this past couple of weeks, I have been playing around with Ubuntu 19.04 on the desktop. I had made a mention of that the last show, but I figured since I was tinkering around with it and beta is, I don't know, this beta has actually been really nice. I figured I might write down my experiences. So I did that. I kind of chronicled the journey over at leochavez.org. And I don't know, there were a few really nice highlights, and snaps were my favorite feature. Snaps have been around for a little while, but I don't know how many of y'all play with snaps, but I'd come back to them every now and again, and less so now that I'm on Mint because flat packs are a thing. But maybe three or four shows ago, I was lamenting the fact that snaps break the theming on your distro. So one of my biggest pet peeves about snaps was that when you moved your mouse into the snap, it went to, like, not your theme. It went down, it failed down to, like, this old-looking X11 mouse theme cursor thing. And, man, it just really broke the immersion. So that was just one thing that has been cleared up now in 19.04. I have to go back and test whether or not that's going to be cleared up in all the other distros that use snap, but I suspect it might be. And, yeah, so there were a few more pressure points that I had kind of written about in that blog post, so if you're curious about that, go check that out. Other than that, I have been playing with Diet Pi, thanks to Peter from Telegram. He had made a mention of Diet Pi, and I was like, that sounds like a really good Pi project, especially since we're coming up to a Pi show. So I'll talk about that a little bit more in the Linux innards. And I got to get my newsreader voice on. So in this podcast, this is mostly me. I try to shear it up just a little bit. I think I'm a little looser while not on the podcast with what I say and how I say it. But right at the moment, I have been chosen. Okay, maybe I begged a little bit, but I was chosen for the Full Circle podcast, and that's just it's a weekly podcast, and really all it is just headlines of the week and a few highlights about that headline. So really, really short podcast. You're looking at probably less than 10 minutes each week, but it really just gets into the meat and potatoes of what happened that week, and that's pretty much it. So I've been practicing my newsreader voice, and we'll see. So I should be, by the time y'all hear this, I should be on the next episode of Full Circle Magazine Podcast.
Do us a favor and drop the RSS.
I've got a link to the current show, but I'll drop the RSS in the check this out section. Awesome. Thanks for the reminder.
That's really cool, man. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. But Bo, so you've been tinkering around with Proton again, I see.
Yeah, well, I had heard that there was an update to Proton, and I think we might have even covered some of the updates to DXVK and Vulkan. But this week, there was a ESO free weekend this past weekend for Elder Scrolls Online. And I had tried Elder Scrolls in the past on Proton, back whenever we first, I think our very first episode, we talked about gaming. One of the games I tried out was Elder Scrolls Online. And at that time, I could get the game to install, but I couldn't actually log in. And I think it had something to do with the fact that it was my first attempt to log into the game, because I never played the game on Windows. I think that the resolution would have been to log in and kind of initiate my account on Windows, and then maybe it would have logged in under Proton on Linux. I'm not positive there. I never tried it, but it didn't work. And so I just left it out of my instructions when we did that episode. But they did the free weekend, and I thought I would just give it a shot to see, you know, how much had changed just in the time period that since we did that past episode. And I literally just installed the game, and it ran as if it were on Windows. I didn't have to do anything, any kind of, you know, changes to config files or anything. It just ran straight on Proton. I have the default PPAs for Steam. And I didn't do anything special there either. It just everything updated to 4.2 and ESO installed with no problem. So almost nothing to report there, except for that it was that easy. And then I also want to touch base with Final Fantasy. I've talked about Final Fantasy 14 on Proton several times, and there is some manipulation that you have to go through normally to get that to install. One is just changing a config file for the browser, because it tries to use a browser that's not native. And then you have to tell it to change the way it does cutscenes, and then the game before would only play on DirectX 9, and you had to run a script that was on a community GitHub to get it to run DXVK instead of DirectX 9. But now, thanks to this new Proton update, if you still have to make the browser change and the cutscene change, but there's no further changes. It will just run in DirectX and DXVK without any modification. So, I basically only play two or three games. But I'm sure that these changes affect other games in the Steam library. So I have a feeling that if you tried something, say, a couple months ago and it didn't work under Proton, try it again. I got a really good feeling that it probably is at least a little better now.
Well, one question and one comment. Do you still have to, and the reason I'm asking is because I haven't touched my Steam install in a long time, but do you still have to swap to the beta channel on Steam in the options to get Proton to work?
Yeah, when you open Steam, let me see, I can open it right now and tell you. When you open Steam, there is a section for Proton. Steam Play is what the section's called. When you go to Steam Play, it has a checkbox already checked to participate in the Steam Play Proton. Basically, the games that have been evaluated by Valve and said to work 100%. But there's an extra checkbox below that, that if you check that box, you're saying you're willing to try Proton on even non-Valve certified games. I don't know what their certification, like, qualifications are, but there's games that run perfectly. Like, I would say Final Fantasy and ESO probably should be verified by Valve and given a gold standard, because they do work out of the box. With some minor tweaks in Final Fantasy's case.
I think the issue there is manpower, getting enough people out there to test.
Right,
I wonder,
for sure.
But there's a community GitHub page where Linux users are saying which ones are working and which ones aren't, and it seems like they would be able to vet through that somehow. I don't know, but I don't have the link here. I'll find it and put it in the notes, but there's a community GitHub that has a listing of every game and even like comments on how to get it to work in cases where it doesn't work. So
very nice.
Yeah, 4.2 seems to be a really big update.
Nice. And one of the other things that I know that Proton does now is that they are allowing you to run games that are not associated with Steam. You should be able to run games that you just installed directly, I guess.
Yeah, I haven't tried that yet, but that's what I was reading too, yeah.
Well, I wonder how... I always come back to World of Warcraft. That's just one game that I play a lot. And well, I guess not here lately, but that's just one that works pretty well in Lutris. Like I'd say it's 95% of the way there for as far as parity to Windows. I wonder how well it runs under Proton. Something to check out. I'll check that out.
For sure.
And Joe, you've been noting it up and playing with some pies, right?
Yeah. Well, a long time ago when Evernote changed their pay model, I decided to switch away from Evernote and started looking for another note-taking application. And SimpleNote simply isn't as good, but hey, it worked. But the problem with SimpleNote is that it is not encrypted at all. And so it's just, plain text, anybody can grab it, whatever. But so I've been looking for alternatives to that. And recently I came across Standard Notes, which is encrypted. I mean, the only person that gets to see my information is me, or if somebody were to get my password and install the app image and run it. And that's another thing I like about it. It runs on app image, so I can run it on basically any Linux system.
That makes a lot of sense, because when I was reading the notes, I saw Standard Notes, and I was like, oh, so he just opens up gedit and writes stuff down. So that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it's an application called Standard Notes. And
my,
it looks like
my viewpoint on that is that the main problem with SimpleNote is you can't archive stuff.
Right. And Standard Notes does have a rather nice archive system, especially if you pay them, because then you can go all the way back through just undoing everything back to the beginning.
Because encryption doesn't do it for me. I'm sharing my notes with my wife all the time and mostly on the phone.
Right. Well, they do have a phone app as well. I just haven't used it yet. And moving on from that, I've also been, of course, playing with my Raspberry Pi. I found one of my old 128 gigabyte USB sticks that I had used Berry Boot with and had several different operating systems on there, including Ubuntu Mate, Raspbian, OpenELEC, and RetroPie. And it still works. I was able to hook it up to the other Berry Boot system that I have, and it was able to read that drive and let me boot straight off of it. And the really nice thing about that is I was able to find my old versions of Marvel vs. Capcom that worked. So I spent several hours playing those games.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, and I did, from Facebook Marketplace, pick up a broken Samsung TV. It's a little 32-inch TV, nothing overly special, but it doesn't power on. And the most likely thing to have been wrong is the power supply circuit board went out. So I took it apart and I looked for puffed up diodes, which you would normally see on a bad power supply board, but I didn't find any. But I did plug it in and you can hear this whine coming off of that power supply board. So I've ordered another one. It only cost me $25 on eBay, and hopefully I will have a semi-free TV to hook up for full-time Pi usage here shortly. And the only other thing I've really been doing is readjusting all my cron tabs to move away from Dropbox to use Resilio Sync instead. And that's about it. Tony, W, what have you been up to?
A lot of Pi stuff, too. And I got a 3B Plus a week or two ago. And I've been playing around with that a lot. Before that, the only Pi I had was a Zero. I don't know why it's taken me this long to get a 3 model, but it has been a ton of fun. I have an arcade cabinet I've talked about on this show before, and that was the main reason I bought the 3B Plus was for use in that. So I won't talk about that too much right now because I'll talk about it in a lot more detail later, but I have been just having a really good time with that. But I tested out some other stuff. I tested out Mate, and I'm still playing around with it. Our family went to Florida for a few days earlier in the week, so I didn't have a ton of time to mess around with it, but last couple of days I've got some good progress on it. And just today I've also been trying out Fedora on the Dell 7130. It's reported to be real touch friendly, so I just wanted to give it a whirl for that reason, really. And I just fired it up just as we were starting here, and I'm kind of using it as a third monitor. I really like it. For the on-screen keyboard, it's really easy. You just kind of swipe up from the bottom, and it brings the keyboard up, and you just tap a button to make it go away. Which device was that on? The Dell 7130.
Okay.
I'm running the Fedora Live USB. And I think so far, it's kind of early because, like I said, it's just been a few minutes I've been playing with it, but so far it seems to be the most touch-friendly distro I've messed with.
Well, we'll have to discuss that.
Yeah. it's a short time to base that on, but I like it anyway. I like the way that the keyboard is out of your way until you call it up and kind of easy to dismiss. I guess that's similar to the way it works in Cinnamon, too, if you set it up that way. But that's about what I've been up to. More on the Pi stuff on the arcade later.
Nice. And we've got Josh has been playing around with A Complete Noob's Guide to Gaming on Linux, right? What's going on there?
Yeah, so I recently subscribed to the the early release schedule for LTT, which is like a big tech YouTube channel. And one of the videos this week was a Complete Noob's Guide to Gaming on Linux. So I play the small minority of games that I play on Windows, and I've heard good things about gaming on Linux, especially with the release of Google Stadia and the developments through that, because obviously that runs on Linux. So gaming on Linux seems to be this major focus for this year, so I thought I'd have a go. So I followed this guide on the video, and it discussed different ways to kind of like attack gaming on Linux. So I think there was three ways. So one of the ways was Wine, which obviously we all know what Wine is. And that was not really a recommended choice to go with. And then there was this option called Proton with Steam Play, which Bo mentioned in his section. And it was actually quite easy to set up. You just went into your settings, enabled it, and then installed your game into the Steam library, and away you went. There was a few bugs, like the startup screen for the game was a bit buggy. It didn't actually show the image, it was just a black box. But once you actually got into the game menu, it was fine from there. And I've actually noticed a double the amount of frames per second on Linux Mint compared to Windows. I'm not quite sure why that is. It might just because obviously, Windows is full of bloatware and Linux Mint isn't. So maybe that's the reason. But I definitely see gaming on Linux being the future of gaming, with obviously it being quicker. And obviously with twice the speed, I'm going to play my games on Linux from now on to get that twice the FPS. And also, I have been playing around with Manjaro on the Raspberry Pi. I won't spoil that too much. All I'll say for now is it is slow, but I'll save more details for the innards later on.
Awesome. And Tony, you've been playing around with another Dell laptop?
I have, yes. I was on holiday for a week, and while I was away, Moss was talking about this new podcast that will go into a little bit later, but I had one of my Dell laptops with me, so I thought I'd stick a new hard drive in it, because I always carry a couple of SSDs around. It's a Dell 6540, a 15-inch Dell. It's a massive 5 pound in weight, so it's not something you lug around all the time, but if you're going to be somewhere for a while, it's a good one. So I stuck it in, stuck the alternate SSD in, kept the Windows one just in case I ever need to stick it back in, and had a play around with that. Even with the Wi-Fi not being brilliant where I was, it only took about half an hour to do the complete install, so everything went smoothly. Although I haven't played around with it an awful lot, I've just kept it as an alternate podcast box, possibly, if anything happens to my main machine, because it's a fairly good, decent machine. And I've also been installing LMDE3 on various machines, including my Toshiba Z30 and my little Dell Z250. I'm not going to say much more about this, because this installing LMDE is going to be the subject of my first distro hopping experience for the new podcast. It's been a bit of an interesting time, a few frustrations and quite a bit of success. So hopefully in a few weeks' time, when we release the show, you'll find out what we've been doing. And in as well as that, to kind of prepare for the show, I've been setting up a new Google account, which will give us access to a blogger blog and various things, so that we can have a dedicated page for the show. So I was doing that today.
So I know you have the domain name. Have you considered paying Google or Microsoft, God forbid, for like storage and email and all that kind of thing?
That is under consideration, but not at the moment. I think we'll see how it goes first, and see how whether our stamina is good for more than one or two episodes before we start lashing out cash.
And because
I've already got
I had been considering that a lot for my own personal blog. Just so I don't have to actually spin up the email server myself. That's one thing that I have told myself I'll never try and do. Just simply because there's so much involved in setting up email. Paying someone $5 a month to handle it all for you is actually kind of nice. And, with Google, it's $5 and you get I think it's a terabyte of storage or something like that. Microsoft has something similar. My domain registrar offers the same thing for a dollar. So it kind of feels easy to do, and not like a dollar for an extra 100 gigs of storage or something like that. So yeah, I just kind of wanted to get your opinion on what you thought on that. So when you think about it more, when you decide to go down that rabbit hole, let me know what you chose.
Yeah, we might get there eventually, but at the moment I'm going with the simple options of using a blogger site, and we'll take it from there. I still got to pick you guys' brains about how to do the links and get it recognised by iTunes and all that once we've stuck it up on archive.org.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
We'll go there.
We'll figure that out.
Reference last episode.
Yes, reference last episode.
Yeah, well, I've got a friendly web host that hosts all my stuff, and sometimes it's free and sometimes it's 10 a month, but that's for the whole web space and everything, and the email is included in that, so we'll think about that.
Yeah, can do. So, Moss, do you want to carry on with what you've been doing?
I went through some issues with what I'm running, but no distro hopping this episode, except... as we've been saying, Tony Hughes and I have taken so much heat on our distro hopping habits that we are striking back by starting a new podcast. It's going to be called Distro Hoppers Digest, and there will be a little bit more details in the announcements part. I'm spending a lot of time on writing the script for the new show, as I also know Tony is, and setting it. We already have a MeWe group for it, so check that out. I will report that I did manage to get SoftMaker Office installed on Solus finally. but still do not have solutions for my other two issues, VPN and printer. I've made some headway on the VPN. I now have WireGuard installed in Solus, but I can't get it to accept the script that Molvad gave me for that. And I'll check on that. I've already reported that to the Molvad people, and we'll see what happens. One of our listeners set up a GoFundMe to get me to go to Self in June. The goal is $750. If we get that, I can afford a room in the convention hotel. Lesser amounts will mean sharing a room or getting a cheaper hotel or other crash space, but I still need to replace my lost income for those two weekend nights, gas and food for myself and my wife for the weekend. This listener did not set it up yet as a beneficiary account, but GoFundMe is working with the two of us to get her to make that change. It's hard to put up a link when we still don't know for sure how this is going to turn out. I have some degree of faith that it's going to work out, but it's going a lot more slowly than I would have expected. In the car department, I have a new one. That's the end of that saga. I wound up with a Mazda 2. It's cute as a button, but I can't do Uber in it, so we're just using the Cobalt for Uber and the Mazda for our other family stuff. And I have a new job, so I'm using that to go to and from work. My mom is still in the rehab facility fighting pneumonia, and we got blindsided by new fees and a rapidly approaching filing deadline to keep my Canadian wife in the country. We've got a fundraiser going on that on GoFundMe. My mom stepped up and donated about almost half of what we said we needed, and we think we've found a way to cut some costs. But life is hitting me in between the ears, and it will continue to do so till we get it all straightened out. I'm bigger than this.
It'll straighten out.
That's about it for me, guys.
All right. Well, I think that's about it for all of our wandering, so we'll head over to the news. All right, and we've got a few news articles that we touched on at the top of the show, and the first one that we've got lined up for us is Asus has more bugs than we thought. This is not really a vulnerability. This is something that was discovered in Asus's firmware update software that has been dubbed since Shadowhammer. And this was basically a way, or basically a bug that would have allowed anybody... Well, okay, so the very beginning of this, the way that it was originally reported, was that Asus was giving everybody viruses, and everybody needed to do something about it, but there was nothing to do about it, so we just need to run around with our heads on fire for a little while. And it wasn't true at all. After a little bit of digging, and Kaspersky did some pretty deep divey research on it, it turned out that it wasn't a mass attack at all, though it was still an attack. It was a very targeted attack at about 600 devices. And we know that because Kaspersky found that this particular virus had a list of 600 MAC addresses baked right into it and would only activate on those devices. So yeah, not a mass attack, it was a targeted attack, but, and this is my speculation on this, there's no way that Asus is holy enough, like there are not enough holes in Asus's security procedures, that someone from the outside were able to get in to all of this and sign the drivers and firmware updates. So the really, I guess, spooky thing about this is that you did not know that any of these binaries or any of this information was actually illegitimate because it was signed by Asus's signing authority, right? So like all these packages, if you checked with Asus, they would have given you the big old thumbs up and said, yep, safe to install. This is exactly what we posted. And I cannot for the life of me believe that Asus has such bad security policies that they were able to lose access to their signing, lose access to their ability to post up new updates, lose access to their website. So all of this smells to me, and remember this is speculation here, smells to me like there was either A, an insider, someone that was paid off or was a vigilante or something like that, that had access to all these things. And why would you give someone access to all of these things, right? Why one person, I mean? Or it was a little more sophisticated and was state-sponsored. So, I don't know. Well, anyway, so Kaspersky had a list of MAC addresses, and they were going to allow you to type in your MAC address into one of their websites, and they would tell you whether or not you were affected, or you could download a little application that you could run on your computer, and it'd be like, you're infected, or you're affected, so do this, 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 and this, right? Well, here's the thing. Kaspersky didn't just tell you what the MAC addresses were. That was obfuscated. And why someone or why a group would not publicize the MAC addresses is kind of beyond me. You had to go to Kaspersky. You had to grovel at their feet, for lack of a better description, to say, hey, please, sir, could I please let me know if my MAC address is affected by any of this? And then Kaspersky would deem you worthy and say yes or no. So Skylight, an Australian company, decided to do something about this. They weren't happy about that. They were like, why can't you just give us the MAC addresses? So they took them. They rented I don't know the exact number, but they rented a bunch of Tesla GPUs from Amazon Web Services and wrote a custom script and just cracked them all. So the MAC address list is posted in the show notes. Just to check, if you're running Asus hardware and you had... and what's funny about this is this a lot of this software can only be run on Windows, so this disproportionately affects Windows devices. So if you're running Asus hardware, you're running on Windows, and over the past year or so had run any of the Asus auto updater stuff, go check your MAC address on that list. Just do a little Control F and see if you are affected. So anyway, long story short, this was a whole lot of teeth pulling, and there really wasn't a whole lot of meat to this, but yet it turned out to be this crazy back and forth story between Kaspersky and Skylight, and yeah, now we finally know the whole story, and it was a little overblown. So but speaking of bugs, Moss has a little bit about these Intel chips. There's an undocumented feature here.
Well, we found another undocumented feature in Intel chipsets. They call it VISA, Visualization of Internal Signals Architecture. It's a debugging technology. It was discovered and revealed at the Black Hat Asia 2019 Security Conference. Researchers from Positive Technologies disclosed the existence of a previously unknown and undocumented feature in Intel chipsets. And there's a graphic on what it does and how it does it. VISA exposes a computer's entire data. Unauthorized access to the VISA feature would allow a threat actor to intercept data from the computer memory and create spyware that works at the lowest possible level. But despite its extremely intrusive nature, very little is known about this new technology. And the documentation is subject to a non-disclosure agreement and is not available to the general public. Intel says it's safe. Researchers disagree.
Well, Intel said AMT was safe until it started being leveraged in the wild from people that had absolutely no physical access to the box at all, right? Yeah. Thanks, Intel. I appreciate you. All right. So for a break from the infectious news stories, we've got some... I guess upbeat news, right? Because Linux Mint has, Clem has posted the Linux Mint monthly news for March. And we got a few cool highlights on what's coming up. And I wanted to get Josh in on this because he's been taking a look at Linux Mint with us as well.
Yeah. So, there's a few things that have been announced, a few things that have been said. I think we'll try and cover the main bits. So the first point is that Linux Mint 19.2 will be codenamed Tina. So that was announced. But at the start of the post, the main highlight of the post, apart from the announcements, is where So you might have remembered that we mentioned, I can't remember, I think it was two shows ago, where we mentioned the announcement that Linux Mint were looking into a new logo and a new website design to update the, I think it's fair to say, the slightly outdated looking website compared to the other distros like Ubuntu, PopOS, and Manjaro, those sort of websites that look quite modern. And it seems to have kind of developed this controversy amongst the Linux Mint community, where people are really, like, not open to change of this new logo and website design. Some of the comments that are mentioned in the monthly news are that people thought the website looked too generic. They didn't want the logo changing. And when I say generic, they didn't like the look of the website, which is fair enough. People had their opinions, I guess. But it seems to, the first part of the blog post seems to have a sort of negative vibe to it, in where the sentence starts, "I personally haven't enjoyed this development cycle." And a few things are mentioned, like obviously the feedback on the new website and logo, and also that two of the more talented developers of Linux Mint have been away. Now, it doesn't actually say why they've been away, but it seems to have this vibe of they aren't liking what people are saying or something like that. And there's a part that says, "I can show them 500 people donated money last month. I can forward emails. I can tell them that they're making a difference. But people want first-hand comments and feedback." So it's kind of a call to the community to maybe interact with the developers. It says, "How our community interacts with our developers is key to their work, to their happiness, and to their motivation." People might read it wrong and take it the wrong way, but I think the overall vibe is people really weren't open to change. People didn't see the point in the new logo and the new website. But like Leo said on our team Discord earlier in the week, 3 months on, will people really be still crying over a new logo and a new website? Will they really care? Will they even remember? I think, obviously, as times go on, people had these certain expectations of what a website should look like. And obviously, a first impression is obviously kind of developed by what people see on the homepage, and the developers obviously want to change that, make it better for new users. And I think we just need to still have an open mind on things, but obviously still give the critical feedback. It's everyone's different opinions, I guess. I wonder what Leo has to say on this.
Yeah, I think this, speaking of overblown stuff, right? Just after I got talking about a bunch of overblown stuff, I think it was really overblown, right? Because we have so Clem a few weeks ago put out kind of like the beta versions of the new logo and kind of a look at the new site. And it seemed to me overwhelmingly that the feedback that he got was just bad. And what I think happens all of the time is that people that like the new logo or the new site won't speak up. And, you know, I'm looking at myself here as well, because I didn't. I could have like at Linux Mint and then been like, that was amazing and it was awesome. But because I personally liked it. I liked it a lot. And so you get that. And then over this development cycle, you have a couple of devs that are in and out for whatever reason, and that sucks. And then you have, during this development cycle, all of the work that they're putting into Muffin and watching regressions pop up left and right, and they're basically having to band-aid this and put out a fire over here. It just makes one big, huge punch in the gut. And we, I think, as people that use software, right? I mean, so this is everybody. I think this is just people in general. We tend to forget, and Josh, I don't know if you get any of this at all, but I think we tend to forget that developers are people, and people like thumbs up, man. Like, if you're gonna go out and make a piece of software, and all you get, you get like 15 pieces of feedback, and 14 of them are, this sucks, and you get the one guy that's like, oh man, this is the best piece of software I've ever used in my entire life, man, make more. You know, like, it's gonna eventually, you know, seesaw your way down to just like, man, I don't know if I want to keep doing this anymore. And not that that's what Clem is saying, because he's not saying that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I am obviously surrounded by a number of software developers that I know, and a common comment that people say, I mean, I say it myself, is you only really hear about the bad things, because, you know, if someone wants to send an email, they're normally highlighting a bug or a feature request and like, oh, I don't like this. And people who really like it don't tend to speak up because they don't feel the need. They don't feel the time to, they don't feel like they need to spend the time to write that email. And I think that's kind of like a flaw within like software projects, that people don't really speak up about the good things, and then some developers can take it bad and like, oh, everyone hates it, what's the point anymore? And maybe I'm guilty myself. Like, if I see a piece of software, then I don't really take the time to email the developer and say, hey, that's really good. But if I find a bug, then I do submit it. And I think maybe that's something we need to do more of.
Yeah, and I think overall, to kind of finish off my thoughts on this, we tend to forget that, you know, devs and, well, I mean, just people in general can get emotional. And when you've been working on a project for years and years and years, it's kind of hard to keep that emotion in check sometimes, because this is Clem's baby, you know, and all of the devs that work on this project, this is something that they put their heart and their soul into. So when, you know, if someone calls your baby ugly, you're like, whoa, man, hey, calm down with that. So I think that's the biggest thing that happened, was just that he kind of expressed that, and we, I think, as people need to accept the fact that, you know, this is his baby, man. So, yeah. Not that we can't criticize his baby, just that, you know, throw in some, but I also like this, too. This is one of the things that I had to do in my blog post, because when I was using the Ubuntu Disco Dingo beta, I was like, yep, this is wrong. Nah, I don't like this. Uh-uh, not this. And then I kind of forgot about halfway through that, like, wait a minute, there have been about 70 different things that I liked about it, and I didn't even think to write it down. So I went back. And I was like, yep, I liked this, and I liked this, and I liked this. And I think that's just something that I personally am going to want to continue to do. And yeah, I might add Linux Mint a little bit more when I find stuff that I do like.
Yeah, definitely. I think obviously you can get overwhelmed by, obviously, with a project the size of Linux Mint. It is one of the most popular Linux distros, and you think how many people use Linux. It's quite a lot. And obviously, if you only had the people who are talking about the bad things, then obviously with a project of that size and you've got 300 negative comments and only like 2 positive comments, then you do get overwhelmed by the negatives. But I think maybe if we do step up all the people who like it and say what we think, then the changes will happen. And it's obviously, it's not a war against the negative side and the positive side. But obviously, if you only hear about what the negative people have to say, then you do get overwhelmed. And then once you don't make the changes because you only hear about the negative things, then all the positive people come up and say, hey, I really wanted that. And then you're like, oh, well, why didn't you say? And you can get stuck in this cycle of people who want the change don't speak up, then the change never happens, and then they get upset about it. You kind of just get stuck in that cycle.
for sure.
Did I fall asleep or did we skip point D, which is that alpha testing of 19.2 is now available and we have a PPA link in the show notes?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I wanted to finish this up on, and one of those is the fonts will change again. For the past couple of iterations, we've been using Noto for our default fonts, and that's going to change back to Ubuntu as it looks a little bit better. And we've also got tons and tons of muffin changes, which is the window manager for Cinnamon, and they've been working on that. And this is kind of part of that whole the missing devs thing and all that work, and it's kind of slowing down because they've made so many changes in Muffin that they keep finding regressions. They keep finding bugs that are popping up, and they have to go squash those things. And then, yeah, lastly, we have, if you are brave enough, and at least at the laptop that I'm looking at, I am not brave enough, you can add a PPA that will get you on to the testing branch of Linux Mint. So if you want to see these changes as they happen in real time and possibly have to put out a fire on your laptop because this crashed or that crashed, add that PPA and you'll be on the bleeding edge of Linux Mint development. Nice. And so, yeah, last thing I'll say on that is, Clem, you are my hero. This is a really good OS.
Buck up, old man.
Ah, yeah, for real. And then, Tony, you are about to tell me about something that I really want to hear about. I need to know about Android apps and Linux.
All right. Well, here it comes then. So, Spurv, this is a way to run containerized Android in Linux. And I'll just say I think this is important because the more apps we have on Linux and the more Linux can do, the better that's going to be for the Linux ecosystem. And this is a different approach than something like Anbox. Basically, what Spurv is doing, I'm just going to hit the highlights. It's a full Android OS that's containerized, including a separate kernel for running Android apart from the Linux OS. It works over Wayland, and this will give full 3D graphics acceleration. And aside from graphics, I think basically this applies for audio and all of the hardware stuff. It's going to allow Android to interface with the hardware pretty efficiently. Pros and cons with this, because you're running basically a full instance of Android on top of Linux, it's not going to be super efficient. You're running two operating systems simultaneously, basically. But because that works that way, there is increased isolation there. You're going to have more security, more privacy. But you're basically going to want to run one Android app at a time with this, and that's kind of what it's designed for. So again, I think it's positive. The more of these kind of things I see, I think this is good. I personally have Android apps that I use for productivity, for different things, for music and whatnot. And, you know, if there are ways to run those on Linux, then that's the way I'll run it.
So, yeah, I've been really surprised over the years that there's not more Android integration into the desktop area. I mean, mm-hmm. Windows has, what is it, Blue something? The application that runs Android apps.
Yeah, is that BlueStacks?
BlueStacks, thank you.
Yeah.
But yeah, but really, what does Linux have to be able to run it?
We have Anbox.
But Anbox isn't all that user-friendly, and it's not all that great on kicking off APKs. So, I'm really surprised that there's not, a pre-set up app image with VNC already set up and ready to go, and you just click on it, and there you go. Android running in its own window.
I agree. And this is where Chrome OS can really come in and eat our lunch a bit, because Android apps are running natively in Chromebooks, and they're very cheap. And, that would do a whole lot of what I would want to do just on a really cheap Chromebook. It's not what I want to do. I'd rather be in Linux, but we would benefit from more Android integration for sure. So I'll be following this.
Yeah, but then you'd have to actually have a Chromebook. All right, and we've got Amazon plans to launch thousands of internet satellites. Josh, you have some on that?
Yeah, so I read this this week, and apparently Amazon want to launch the satellites in order to launch a broadband service. So these satellites are going to cover, they say, 95% of the population in the world, so 95% of where people live on the planet. So their plan is to launch a broadband service, and I think this is quite, well, strange. Obviously, what they want to do is to get better internet in rural areas, but do you really want a company as big as Amazon knowing what you search? And there's all sorts of different issues that might crop up, and they may force Amazon as your homepage. Who knows? I wonder.
It may also be pointed out, Josh, yeah, that there are three other companies that have already gotten this type of approval, and SpaceX already has two satellites out there.
Yeah. So,
Good.
So, I'm not sure if they have the approval yet. They might do, but it definitely sounds interesting. But also, I see why some people might be scared. Obviously, if someone like Facebook, who's been having all these privacy issues recently, launched a broadband service, I'm sure a few people would have a couple of things to say about that.
I'm one of those few people, and if I may put my cynical hat on for just a minute, any company that their number one moneymaker is you is gonna be a hard no from me as far as letting them be my ISP, because that just tells me that they're gonna be hoovering up absolutely everything that I'm doing and seeing and whatever. And, you know, if I have to pay for internet service from an ISP, and then there is no doubt in my mind that I have to also use a VPN just to, you know, keep their prying eyes away, then, man, that I want to rethink that ISP choice. But, yeah, where
but
I'm
again,
at now,
they're
going
to be in competition with other companies, so they can't try and steal all your data if there's other people that only want to steal less of it.
Well, let's not forget that Amazon's MO is to undercut the competition so steeply that the competition goes away, and then they are the only one left to provide.
If you've got a bunch of little fleas floating around in space, you are already in the game.
Well, right, but yeah, we'll just see.
If it was the only service available, you'd still end up using it.
Well, yeah, absolutely, and that's where my VPN thing came in.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, I mean, I'll buy a VPN if I have to, but I don't want to have to. That's the point. And then Huawei has another bug. Speaking of bugs,
yeah. So another one that I picked up on this week. So it just seems to be getting worse for them as the days go by. They seem to be in the news with all sorts of scandals. I think one of them the other week was this company had developed a new screen technology. They asked for a sample, they agreed to return it in 2 weeks, and about 5 months later they got it returned with it all cracked and opened up. Basically, it looks like they took this sample so that they could clone it and use it in their own devices. But this recent story, this recent story was a flaw that had been found by Microsoft researchers in their MateBook laptops, which looked surprisingly like a mix of the Dell XPS 13 and the MacBook. Which is pretty standard for Huawei, because that's what they like to do. And it could have been used to take control of machines, apparently. And the flaw had been introduced by Huawei at the manufacturing stage. And they're actually under increasing scrutiny around the world over how closely it is tied to the Chinese government. So lots of flaws with them.
Yeah, and that's coming straight off of, and what you just mentioned coming straight off of the fact that they have been denied in the U.S. from producing any of the 5G equipment that we're going to be using. when we roll ours out. So, yeah, not good news for Huawei. Just add it to the pile.
Yeah, there's a bit at the bottom of the post that says they are critical to 5G, which in turn will be critical to a whole range of things, including future cities and autonomous cars. Disrupting this network could cause huge disruptions to society, and I can see why people are worried about Huawei supplying this technology with all these scandals that are going on with them. Obviously, with them being linked to governments, allegedly, and all that sort of thing, and all the security flaws that are being found, people are to be concerned if they're going to be the main people rolling out this new 5G.
Absolutely. All right, and that's all we've got for the news, so we'll head over to our Linux Innards section. And first up, we have Joe, and he's been playing around with some Alexa.
Yes, I have. You know, I've been talking about getting this build done for a while, but I finally got Alexa Pi set up on my Raspberry Pi B3 Plus.
Is it still taboo to yell out Alexa?
It probably is, and I probably shouldn't say it, but expect me to say it a lot in the next few minutes.
You should yell it out and tell, like, the thermostat to turn up.
Right. get it to tell everybody dirty knock-knock jokes.
Even
okay.
Better.
Okay, so like I said, I've been trying to get this set up for a while using different write-ups. Finally, I found a decent write-up that came straight from Amazon at developer.amazon.com, and I will leave a link for that in the notes. And the first thing you have to do is set up the device through Amazon, and there are detailed instructions on that. On how to get it all set up on developer, you do need a developer.amazon.com account. So once that's all set up, they have further instructions on what to download to your system and how to run it. Once it's all downloaded, there's a setup file that you run. It's a setup.sh file, so it's all scripted out for you. The problem is that setup file dies constantly. And it even says in the write-up that if it dies, if it locks up your system, just restart and start again. So it doesn't start from the beginning. It continues from where it last successfully installed something. And it installs quite a bit. But I think I was up to like 20 times having to restart that Raspberry Pi. And in the end, I dropped down out of the GUI and just did it all straight from terminal. But it did finally install, but it did not install correctly. One of the items that was supposed to be installed was SQLite3, and I ended up having to install that manually because the test script that they give you couldn't find any information there, and I went and looked, and it was blank, so a manual install fixed that problem. And it does require a USB microphone. You cannot use the 3.5 millimeter jack and hook up a microphone to that. So right now, my Snowball is hooked up to my Raspberry Pi running Alexa. And the next thing you have to do is download the config.json file that Amazon will generate for your specific device. And there is a setup script and there is a test app script that comes with all the downloads from Amazon. Once you get that running, it's all working. I do have a couple of small problems with it, though. Amazon recently changed their policies, and on these DIY devices, you can no longer do Amazon Music. It won't work at all, and it's set up that way. They want you to create a commercial account if you're planning on using Amazon Music with your own device. But it will control my lights, and it will tell me jokes, and just about anything else. It gives me the weather, which is, you know, what I need in the mornings. And the other problem I have with it, and I don't know if it's a problem with the script itself, how Amazon has it set up, or if it's the Raspberry Pi, but it skips the first few words in anything that it's outputting. So, like, the first two, sometimes three or four words, that audio doesn't come through, but then the rest of the audio does. I'm still troubleshooting that. I haven't had it working very long, and I might just try switching over to, because it's hooked up over HDMI right now. I'm thinking if I switch to the 3.5 millimeter jack for the audio output, that might work. And that's pretty much the Alexa Pi setup. And also, somebody in our Discord mentioned PyVPN, so I decided to give it a try and set that up on the same Pi with the Alexa Pi setup on it. And it was actually really easy to do. I mean, it's all scripted out. You install it, and you go through the setup. It walks you through everything, and then once that's done, it is ready to go. Now, I did have a problem when I first set it up where I was able to connect to the VPN, but only from within the local area network, which told me that there was something wrong with how it was seeing my DNS. So I did have to completely uninstall it and reinstall it and make sure that the DNS settings were correct in the initial setup. And once that was done, everything has worked like a charm. And that's really all I have. Tony W., you were also working on some Pi fun.
Yes, sir. So on this show a couple episodes back, I was talking about a arcade cabinet that I have and wanting to replace the computer inside it with a Pi. So that's what I've been playing with. It's been pretty fun. I bought a 3B Plus maybe a week ago. And so this cabinet that I have, some of the hardware bits that I was working around, I am using a monitor for output. So no HDMI on this monitor. Using a sound bar that has a 3.5 millimeter input. And also the arcade cabinet had some controls that I put in that I had not gotten to work under Linux previously. That ended up being pretty easy. But basically, to make all this work, I did have to get a HDMI to DVI cable that was like, you know, $8 on Amazon. So that was pretty easy. And other than that, let's see, the Pi, you definitely need the power adapter that's intended for the Pi. I think you guys have mentioned that earlier on, and that is definitely true. I tried some other things and ended up having to get the original one that's intended to run it. So once I had all of that, I went ahead and set up RetroPie on the 3B Plus. And there are a couple of options. I did consider some other things. I was looking at Laka and some other options. What ended up selling me on RetroPie is just the customization. I really like the theming, and you can kind of make it look how you want. So I ended up settling on RetroPie, used Etcher, set up the SD card. That's all pretty easy. Interestingly, I was looking at transferring ROMs to RetroPie once I had it set up, and you're supposed to be able to just create a folder called RetroPie on a flash drive, pop that into the Pi, and it should fix it all up and put subdirectories within that with all the different systems, so you know where to put all the ROMs. That didn't work out for me. I'm not really sure why. That RetroPie folder just disappeared every time I tried to plug it into the Pi. So I ended up just using SD card reader and loaded the ROMs that way. And The Nintendo, Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, Atari, all that stuff worked really, really easily. I mean, I'm used to configuring emulators and doing that stuff back to, you know, the late 90s. And for this to just work, you just put the ROMs on there and it just, you know, works like magic. It's really cool. Arcade is a little bit of a different story. I learned a little bit when it came to arcade ROMs. So bear with me here, and I'll kind of take you through what I learned on this. It's not real deep, but, you know, there are some things you have to understand. Arcade ROMs are a little trickier than the console ROMs. So there are multiple arcade emulators that are available to use in RetroPie, and generally it's recommended to use either MAME 2003 or Final Burn Alpha, I believe it's called, for fighting games. But what's recommended is that you use a full set of ROMs and not just a partial list or incomplete set. So I did initially try a couple of just ad hoc games that I had pulled from a collection that I already had, and it wasn't working out with some of them. So I did download a full set of MAME 2003 ROMs, and interestingly enough, they were hosted on archive.org is where I ended up finding them. I thought that was kind of neat. So I downloaded that ROM set, ended up being 4,765 ROMs, I believe. Which
that's,
actually
that's
put
just
me
a
in
few, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was more than I'll play, probably, by a lot. That actually put me into needing a bigger SD card too. I was playing around with a 32 gig card, and then I got all those arcade ROMs, and it was like 31 point something. I was like, oh, here comes a trip to Micro Center. But got all that loaded up, and once I did have the full ROM set loaded, and use that with MAME, all of the ROMs I've tried so far have worked. So it required a little bit of reading. Wasn't too bad, but, you know, you do want to have a full arcade ROM set, and it is going to be about 32 gigs for this MAME set that I got. But once I got that going, even the, you know, Marvel versus Street Fighter and all that kind of stuff that can be finicky worked just fine in MAME, actually. So that was fun. I applied a theme. I used the comic book theme. I kind of like that. Again, that was very easy too. If you want to theme RetroPie, it's built into the menus. You just go and look at the emulation station themes. You can download them right from the Pi. And so everything that I wanted this thing to do, which is mostly play arcade, I have nearly 5,000 arcade games. That all works just fine. Nintendo, Super Nintendo, Sega, and Atari. Actually, I even tried PlayStation 1 just for kicks, and those games work too on the Pi. Pretty well, actually.
Whoa, okay. I got a couple questions for you now. How well do PS1 games play?
Definitely playable. I did not go to the trouble to get a BIOS to load there, and that does make the compatibility potentially a little better and possibly make the games run better. But I didn't, you know, I played Tony Hawk for a few minutes, and it seemed to run just fine as far as I could tell.
That is the game to play. So
yes, sir.
Then my other question is, speaking of games to play, what is the game that you've been playing the most since you got this up and running?
You know, actually, my answer on that one is a little bit odd because it's Tetris. And my wife and I used to play that, you know, a lot decades ago. And my 11-year-old, he judged it a little prematurely and just assumed it would be boring and he'd want nothing to do with it. And he got sucked in.
Oh, see, Tetris is like that, though. I love Tetris. I don't think that's an odd answer at all. That's just one I can. It's like Civ, right? When you start playing it, You kind of lose track of all time and everything, and you're just working on this puzzle, and like you look up at the clock and it's like been an hour and you're like, what happened?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you should definitely check out some of the Genesis games. Go and play Shadowrun.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Ooh. Yeah.
Okay.
And as far as puzzle games go, you probably have it in that massive archive that you got. But if you like puzzle games like Tetris, you might want to try Puyo Pop. It came out in America under Kirby's Avalanche. And man, that was something that me and my dad played when I was younger. And man, we would sit there. I mean, we would seriously sit there for hours and just, you know, between us or play the computer or whatever. And we got really good at that game. But I was reading some article on that was linked in Reddit or something like that. Oh, no, it was an Ask Reddit or something. And everybody was going on and on about, you know, what did you think you were good at until you met someone that was a pro at it? And then, yeah, that's kind of how I would be, I'm sure, if I ever met anybody that could play that game really well. And it would just stomp me, even though I feel like I could play that game pretty well.
From archive.org, was that the Final Burn Alpha that you grabbed?
It was the MAME.78 set, which is MAME 2003.
Oh, can you drop a link?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple more things I was going to say on this cabinet situation. I'll just say, if anybody's thinking about doing this with a full cab, I would encourage you to just kind of look around and see if anybody is selling non-working units. I happened to buy the one that I have for $20, and it was just a gambling kind of a game, like you see in some of the convenience stores. And a guy had a store unlocked just full of them. So I don't have a lot of money in this thing. I had the cab and I bought the controls off eBay. Everything else pretty much was free until I bought the Pi. The controls I bought off of eBay, I had never gotten to work under Linux before, but I just, you know, when it didn't work automatically, I just kind of bailed on it. That ended up being really, really easy. Like, I felt silly. It was so easy. I the controls show up as Xinmo, X-I-N-M-O, and I just looked that up, and sure enough, there was a little line of code you can add to a file on the Pi, and voila, it detected as two controllers instead of one, which was the problem I was having before. So really, this was not too much work, not as much as I thought it might be. The other thing I'll mention here that I just thought was kind of neat, and I'll probably just kind of end on this. There are some optional packages in RetroPie, some stuff that I didn't really know existed. And one of the things that is available is Kodi. You can load Kodi as an optional package and run it from within RetroPie, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Where is that at in the GUI?
Yeah, it's... I just read it real quick. I haven't actually done it yet, but it's in optional packages in the setup menu.
Okay.
And one other thing that I would suggest on that cabinet is if you've got a college or university around you that opens their machinery up to the public. I know we have at the school that I work at, we have a bunch of 3D printers that we make available to anybody. They can just come in and you know, sign in and use them. And we also have another college around here that opens up their CNC machine to the public. So between those things, we've got a project going on between our department and the CAD guys, and they are CNCing together an entire cabinet. So the whole thing from top to bottom, they're gonna feed that into a machine and out pops a disassembled cabinet. So they're gonna have the IKEA,
nice,
the IKEA thing to deal with. They got to screw it all together without instructions. They get to do that themselves. And our department is going to be putting together the Pi and getting it on Wi-Fi, and then getting it to the point where we can like move it to any spot and play it. But it's going to be available in our library after a little bit of show and tell.
And, option for that might be your local makerspace, which should have, yes, all of those tools in one central location.
Yeah, our library has a makerspace, but they don't have a CNC machine. But yeah, man, just look around. Take a look at some of the public options that you have in your town or your city, because there might be a lot.
Yep, and that's, you want to have space for this if you're going to do it, you know, obviously, because a Pi is tiny, you don't need to take up a bunch of room with a cabinet if it's not something you want. But if you have the space for it, or if you can talk your wife in on letting you put it in the kitchen like I did, it's a lot of fun.
Nice. And Josh has been playing with a lot of Pi stuff. You've been testing out Manjaro, right?
Yeah, so instead of doing a Pi project, I thought I'd try out a new Pi distro for a week. So I stick to Raspbian. I've never actually moved from Raspbian except trying out Ubuntu once, but I didn't really get far with that. And so I saw Manjaro for ARM. I can't remember when I came across it, but it was quite recently. And I thought, oh, let's try this out. So obviously Manjaro, if you're familiar with it, is based on Arch, and Raspbian, as the name suggests, is based on Debian. And I didn't actually realize that Arch doesn't have apt, so that was that took some getting used to. But going back to the start, installation was quite a pain. All you had to do was install an image, and it was a compressed image. I think it was in a 7-zip file format. And then you had to extract that to get the ING file. And then I just used Etcher even to flash to the SD card. And I installed it and I hooked it up to my little Raspberry Pi touchscreen. And the actual screen wasn't working. So I pulled out the power and I corrupted the SD card. So I was back to square one, flashed the SD card again. And then I got to a point where it asked me for a username and password. So I typed that in, and then it went to so you know, like when you boot up Linux and you get all the scrolling text, it got to a point where it said something like VC and then a few numbers from simple, and then it just hung there. So back to square one again, flashed the SD card, typed in a different username and password this time, and with a few reboots, because it didn't actually work for a few times, after a quick few reboots, I managed to get to the logon page, and I logged in, and it is very, very slow. This is probably because it's not as well optimized as Raspbian, because obviously Raspbian is developed by Raspberry Pi themselves, so it's a first party operating system, and it's obviously well tied in with the hardware. Manjaro ARM wasn't. It was usable, but definitely with using Raspbian for a few years, you definitely notice a difference, and it was pretty much unusable for what I needed to do. Because so far I haven't figured out how to do GPIO stuff, so I didn't manage to get any LEDs flashing or any boards working. But I might try that again next week and see how far I get with that. I know a few people on Twitter tried to get it working and they didn't have any luck either. But if you want to try out Manjaro on the Raspberry Pi, it's definitely worth a try. But I am looking forward to going back to Debian and Raspbian next week.
Very cool. And then, Tony, you had a little bit about some Ubuntu Mate news, right?
Yeah, I've not been doing much on the Pi myself just recently, but I was listening to a couple of podcasts, and Martin Wimpress, who develops the Mate version of Ubuntu, was talking about Ubuntu Mate for the Raspberry Pi Model 2, 3 and 3 Plus. And apparently the hardware acceleration on the latest 18.04.02 or 0.2 is improving the hardware acceleration, so it's going to make things like playing video, YouTube and things like that a lot smoother and a lot better kind of experience for the user. So it might be worth checking that out. I was planning to install this onto my Pi 3 that I've got, but I never got round to it, being busy with other things this week. But I'm going to try and give that a try before the next show. But if anyone else out there fancies a go, maybe it's worth a try if you need your Pi to run video.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of tough for me because I have to decide what I want to do with this Pi that I'm playing with now.
Well, I've put a link in the show notes to the Ubuntu Mate for Raspberry Pi page, so you can have a read of it, and there's links there for the download and everything if you want to give it a shot. And all the new features that are enabled are also on that page. That's about it. So, Moss, you've not got anything going this time because you've not got a Pi, so I'm going to hand back over to Leo.
All right. Yeah, so I've been, it was mentioned in the Telegram that diet pie was a thing. And so at the very beginning, I had no idea what the heck diet pie was, but it sounded like a really, you know, trimmed down operating system for the Pi. And I was partially right in that. So Diet Pi is kind of like the gateway to anything that a Pi can do. It's just like you run the little Diet Pi software package, and it gives you this massive list of all of the things, like anything, all the things, everything that you could ever want to do on a Pi, and, you know, even stuff that'll choke up a Pi. But yeah, so thanks to Peter for pointing this one out, because I fell in love with Diet Pi. So the first thing, the very first thing that I had learned about Diet Pi, well, I guess before that, I used Etcher for the very first time to write a Pi image to an SD card. I usually just use DD because, you know, I've always just used DD, but I was like, I've got the Etcher app image. I guess I'll do it. You know, it worked like you'd expect. So, you know, props to them. It worked. But the very first thing that I learned after I booted up Diet Pi for the first time was that HTOP is already installed, and I love me some HTOP. So I launched HTOP, and I learned that Diet Pi, including HTOP, there are two facts here. One, 10 processes in all, and that includes HTOP, so really 9. And the total memory usage is 28 megabytes of RAM. Now, I'm not coming from a deep knowledge of Raspbian or anything like that, but I would suspect that even if you don't launch the GUI, Raspbian's going to be using a little bit more than 28 megabytes of RAM. So that just blew me away. The fact that you get like 99% of the total RAM on your Pi by using Diet Pi is amazing. So Diet Pi. So let me actually tell you what Diet Pi actually is. It's a platform. It is a platform for Raspberry Pi so that you can look through the list of all of the supported applications and unsupported applications. You don't even have to just run what Diet Pi makes available to you. You can make it do anything that you want to on this really stripped down version of Debian. It was Debian Stretch. That's right. So what I did find, though, is I was kind of scrolling through all of the different stuff that I've got, that you've got available in Diet Pi, was that you get desktops like Mate and XFCE. You get remote desktop. And I know this might make Joe sad, but X2Go was not an option in there, but VNC and No Machine. So No Machine is X2Go with some extra proprietary bits on it. So it's kind of in there just a little bit. But yeah, so you get the media systems and players like Kodi and Plex, and we have the ability in Diet Pi to launch Murmur, which is a mumble server. So just in case we need a mumble alternative for a couple hours, Murmur is available to us, and we can spin that all up within about an hour. And we've got torrents and downloading, so you can do transmission and sonar and radar and all that kind of fun stuff. You've got cloud and backup, so you can run Nextcloud and sync thing, gaming. So it doesn't, RetroArch and RetroPie were, or the things that those run, weren't actually in the list, which is kind of odd. But, you know, things like AmiBerry and MineOS for Minecraft were in there. And, you know, to avoid listing off absolutely everything, I'll just kind of go over some of the categories that you get. You got social for WordPress and surveillance and hotspots and system statistics and hardware projects, stacks like LAMP and LIMP, PiHole, PiVPN are options in there. You can do file serving, basic file serving, home automation and printing. So, you know, make yourself a print server or something like that. And one of my favorite things, and I've always meant to do this project, but I never got around to it, was, and I know I'm probably going to not pronounce this right, but Tautuli? It's the Plex monitoring service that will kind of give you stats on who's watching what videos, what user watched so many hours of videos, who's the most watched user on your Plex server or whatever. But it gives you some really nice charts and graphs and information that you wouldn't get otherwise, right? I mean, you can't get this from the Plex panel. You can get some, but you know, even if you pay for Plex, you can get even more. But
Tau Tuli will give you way more than you ever thought possible from your Plex. So I thought this write-up was going to go a little differently than it did, because I didn't really fully understand what Diet Pie was. So when I was, you know, I shot my hand up, I was like, yeah, I'll do Diet Pie. That sounds cool. I didn't realize that it was going to be so skinny. And that's just because Diet Pie is not the point. Diet Pie is just an implementation detail to get you where you want to go, and where you want to go might be Nextcloud or WordPress or something like that. So for a no-fuss gateway drug to installing any kind of Linux app that you could get your hands on, Diet Pie seems to be the best option that I have found to get all this stuff up and running. And I mean, you do not need to have a whole lot of knowledge. If you can flash an SD card, you can figure out Diet Pie, because it will quite literally hold your hand through every step of the way. And, you know, once you get to, you know, like if you decided to do Nextcloud or something like that, once you get to the part where you're logging into Nextcloud, then you just go check out Nextcloud's documentation on how to set that stuff up, and then, you know, they'll hold your hand the rest of the way. So Diet Pie. If you've got a pie lying around and you don't know what to do with it, go put Diet Pie on it, because you'll have a gajillion and one options. And well, if your problem is not knowing which of the million options to choose, then I guess I can't help you. But you know what? Join the Telegram group and we're going to figure out what to put on your pie if you can't do it yourself. And yeah, just have fun with it. I could not believe how easy it was to get all of this stuff set up. And yeah, I was kind of scared of Tau Tuli. And then Diet Pie was just like, here, let me do it all for you. And I was like, all right, I'll let you do that. That sounds good. Anyway, so that's it for my ramblings on the Diet Pie. So that'll do it for our Linux Innards section. And if you or someone you know wants to get in on some of this pie action, point them over to the Discord channel or the Telegram group, and we'll figure it out. Now onto the vibrations from the ether. So our makeup of vibrations from the ether actually are morphing right before our eyes. And one of the things that has never happened to us before is that we didn't get our normal, you know, dozen, two dozen messages into like mintcast.org or, you know, just the usual spots. And, well, direct email as well. And I think I have it figured out. We've broken down the barriers to communication between us hosts and you listeners. And we're kind of mixing that up a little bit, because we've got people like Peter and Frank that are contributing all the time in the background, and Crypto Dan as well, that are contributing all over the place. And we don't really have a need for direct email as much, or direct posting at mintcast.org as much. And, you know, these avenues of conversation are still open to absolutely anybody, and, you know, they'll continue to be open. But what we're seeing is that we're having more of a conversation rather than a, here's an email, here's a response, and then we kind of dictate that on the show. So to my point, we didn't have anything for vibrations that wasn't a conversation. So what I did was I just went into our Telegram group and pulled out one of the more interesting conversations that we were having there. And it was a question posed by Scott in the Telegram group. And he wanted some suggestions for a password manager that he could use, you know, for his day to day. And so my question was, you know, do you want local storage or cloud storage? And, you know, Scott didn't care one way or the other. So I recommended a handful, and I recommended NPass or Bitwarden for local storage. This is one of the ones that these are types of password managers that you have full control of. And, you know, these things don't ever get sent anywhere. They're all just for you to use. And you can copy your stuff over from device to device if you'd like. And since he said, you know, cloud was something that was a consideration as well, I recommended LastPass. LastPass seems to be the number one cloud storage password management solution, blah, blah, blah. No, we're not getting paid by LastPass, but yeah, it turns up. So And, you know, on the back of that, Peter came in and recommended LastPass as well as something that he used. Frank came on the back of that and said he uses Bitwarden. So that's vote number two for Bitwarden as a local storage, or KeePass XC. And then Crypto Dan added his two cents in and saying that he uses Chrome's built-in manager. And this would be kind of a cloud share option. All you got to do is just run Chrome or Brave or Chromium or anything pretty much. And this will probably include Microsoft Edge soon enough. But you'll be able to run all of those and just log into your Chrome Cloud Share and just start sharing your passwords across all of the devices. Since Chrome and Chromium run just about anywhere, that means that, yeah, it's a pretty full-fleshed out solution. And then Moss, his two cents was, use Firefox's version of that. And yeah, I mean, if it weren't any of the ones that I had mentioned before, yeah, I trust Firefox. Firefox is, big old fat high five to Firefox. Their manager is actually quite usable. So, yeah. If any of you had any questions about what kind of password manager to use, there are some options and certainly some recommendations from our regular contributors. So thank you all for that. I really do appreciate it. And yeah, keep that discussion coming. We're seeing a lot more discussion happen in Telegram. We're seeing our Discord discussion crop up a whole lot more often. So thank you all for all of the feedback and all of the conversations so far. It's getting pretty darn interesting in those avenues. All right. So that's it for our vibrations. We'll head on over to our last couple sections of the show. We'll start with Check This Out. All right. And for me, I've got a few different things. During my Disco Dingo beta, foray, I've got a link to my blog post in here if anybody decides they want to read it. I've also got a couple of links to Full Circle Magazine, who I'll be hosting for here pretty soon, and the latest episode of Full Circle Podcast. I'll also go in and add a link to just more general Full Circle information down here as well. But one of the things that I had found while I was doing my beta searching and beta using was an application called Stacer. I think that's
which I recommended to you maybe four episodes ago.
Maybe that's where it came from then. Okay, cool. So I finally got around to it then, Moss. And the reason that I liked it so much was that it's an app image. So you just go download the thing and run it. So Stacer is a very colorful glances or H-top replacement that is pretty darn good looking, if I do say so myself. And this is something that I feel like would be a great addition to a Pi that you don't know what to do with and you just want it to monitor something. You can get maybe Stacer to do that for you. So either way, go check out Stacer, go download that app image, go run that real quick and see all the information. It's more than just glances. It's more than HTOP. It's also system information that, you'd have to run two or three commands to get a hold of. So go check out Stacer. It's really, really cool. And then Moss had some. Check this out as well.
Hey, Tony Hughes and I are working on a new monthly podcast named Distro Hoppers Digest. We'll be evaluating two new distros each episode. The first episode will feature moderately deep dives into LMDE3 Cindy and Solus OS 4. I think that's transmission. We should be recording toward the end of the month. Stay tuned and we'll let you know when it's hot and ready for downloading.
Very cool. I really want to know how you guys get along with Solus OS, because it's, after Linux Mint, it's got to be one of my favorites.
Well, we originally were just going to do LMDE. And I'm going, well, I already have Solus on here. And if we only did one distro, that's 12 a year. And I'm sure they're coming out a lot faster than that. And
yeah. Do y'all plan on doing beta testing as well, or just?
Well,
like,
everything that Tony looked at about LMDE was exactly what I'd already experienced with LMDE. And so I'm going, why should I just sit here and echo everything you said when I've got something else we can do, and we can do at least 24 distros a year.
For sure. All right.
Yeah, we could have a look at betas in the future, but at the moment, I think we'll stick for distribution releases because they're going to be the more useful to the listeners, hopefully.
Yeah, we definitely want to give out things that people can use. We'll tell them how easy or difficult they are to use and how worth it.
I said, well, the reason I asked about the beta thing was that I came away from my beta testing of Ubuntu with the thought that I had actually forgotten it was a beta. I only had one crash, and it was in gedit. And what? I didn't know gedit crashed, but apparently it does. And yeah, like that was the only real issue I had during the entire beta test. So I was thoroughly impressed with how well the beta went.
Yeah, the only problem with that is not all of our listeners have got loads of hardware to throw things on to do a real-world test. So you don't want to be putting beta releases onto your main machine.
Yeah, we do the hopping for you. Then you decide, hey, that sounds good. Let's try it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It's a really good name, Distro Hopper Digest.
I know. That was gold, man.
Yeah, we've got. I've managed to get the blogger page set up for it, so yeah, we're good to go.
Cool. And Josh had a few things as well.
Yeah. So, on last Sunday, actually, I released a new issue of a magazine that I am the assistant editor of, and it's based around the Micbit microcontroller, which is a £12. Or I don't know what that is in dollars, about $15, a little board with a LED matrix display, mainly used with kids, but adults use it as well. And it's a free magazine, and we've now been around for a year. We thought it was going to flop after the first issue, and readership is now in the tens of thousands. So check it out at the link in the show notes.
Quarterly?
Gee, maybe we should put a link for Mintcast in it.
Sure. I'll add that in.
You said you've been doing it for a year, so it's a quarterly magazine?
So when we say a year, so we actually launched so we release it every 3 months, but when we say a year, we got the website up and running and release it, because it's a community-written magazine, so we give people about 2 to 3 months to write the articles, and then we release the magazine after that. So it releases every 3 months, and it's a year since we opened the first call for contributions, so it'll be a year since the first issue at the start of July.
Okay.
But yeah, we're looking to have it monthly quite soon.
That'd be interesting. I'm going to have to go take a look.
Okay, well, I found an interesting story. I actually heard it on Tech Thing, one of the video podcasts that I watch, and it involves Cloudflare, who recently brought us a DNS service that is free and I have had zero problems with since I switched to it. And it's supposed to be faster, and the tests that I have seen online have showed it to be somewhat faster, and that's 1.1.1.1. That they gave us. Well, now those same people are eventually going to have a ads-free VPN. Well, a free VPN. Okay. And I have a link for that in the show. It's not available yet. And from what I understand, there is already a considerable waiting list for people to test it out. So no telling when that will be available to everyone. But if you're looking for a free VPN, these guys might be the place to stop in the future. And like I said, they've been really good about their DNS service that they're providing for free, and they so far haven't had any data breaches. They haven't been caught selling your information or anything like that. So I thought it was something interesting that people could find in the future.
Heck yeah, because Cloudflare does a lot for free. They have a free tier of their Cloudflare website protection service, which protects against DDoS. They have this DNS service that I've been using for a few months now, and now they have a VPN. This is amazing.
Yeah, not quite yet.
I'm really digging that.
But they're working on it.
All right, man. I mean, at the very least, it's going to be like a backup VPN for me, because I've already got a couple, but man, yeah, it's going to be a nice option.
Right. I like PIA, but I'll probably try this out as a backup or as a secondary.
For sure. All right. And we've got a section here at the end so that we can let everybody know where to find all of us outside of this podcast, just in case you can't get enough of us. If 2 weeks cadence is not fast enough for you and you want to get a hold of us in different places, let's start with Joe. How can we find you?
Well, if you enjoy my dulcet tones, you can catch me on two other podcasts. That's the Linux Link Tech Show, which is at www.tllts.org, or the Linux Lugcast, which is www.linuxlugcast.com, all one word on the Linux Lugcast. And I'm on both of those shows every Wednesday for the tilts and every first and third Friday of the month for the Linux Lugcast. You can also send me emails at jb@mintcast.org or find me on MeWe.
Nice. And how do I get a hold of more Bo?
I do three other podcasts. You can find all three of those over at undercastnetwork.com.
Cool. And Moss, where can I find more of you?
Well, I've got websites at Triad Bardic College, Peaceful Hippo, and Bandcamp. I am on MeWe. I am all over YouTube on various pages. My own is Zaivala, Z-A-I-V-A-L-A, and moss@mintcast.org.
And Tony, where can I hear more Tony? Tony Hughes.
Hi, you can find me at Hacker Public Radio, and I'm host ID 338. I also do an occasional blog. I've got my blog site, which is https://tony-hughes.blogspot.com. And I'm on Twitter at TonyH1212. And you'll shortly be able to get us via the new podcast. We'll release the email address for that probably next show. Oh, I'm also on th@mintcast.org as well.
Very nice. And Tony Watts, where can I get more Tony Watts?
You can always reach me at tw@mintcast.org.
Nice. And I've got a couple of different spots where you can find me. You can find me at leochavez.org, where I keep a, slow going blog. You can find me at Twitter at Leo Chavez, or you can find me at all of the various Mintcast, the Telegram, the MeWe group, the Discord group. And finally, Josh, where can we find more of you?
You can find me at edublocks.org, so EDUBLOCKS, and all about code on Twitter with underscores between the words.
Very nice. And before we leave, we want to make sure to acknowledge some of the people who make Mintcast possible. Kay Wisher for the PiCaster, a Raspberry Pi that streams each episode as we record it, the folks at Hacker Public Radio for the Mumble server we use to communicate, and the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro we love to talk about every single couple of weeks. Yeah.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem.
Don't forget archive.org.
You're my hero, Clem.
This has been another episode of the Mintcast podcast. The show notes for this episode are at mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. You can find more information about Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter, @mintcast and @linux_mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com for our theme music, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Mintcast.